Welcome to Passion to Power with your host, Michelle Zeitlin. She's a creative producer who quote-unquote wears many hats. She's also a talent and literary manager and founded the company Morzap Productions and Management. She develops people and projects across all media. Her guests encompass the gamut, from artists to authors, actors to activists, programming executives, development executives, and A&R. Michelle Zeitlin is excited to share her tips and tools for success through her conversations mostly via Zoom during quarantine. Please welcome Michelle Zeitlin, Passion to Power.
If you're an author and you want to learn what an acquisitional editor does for the major publishers, you'll want to listen carefully to this marvelous conversation with Kendra Levin. Not only is she an editor for Simon & Schuster that works in the children's book division, handling children's picture books, middle grade, and young adult books, but she's also an author herself of a book called The Hero Is You.
I'm Kendra Levin, and I am editorial director of Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers, which is our flagship children's trade imprint at Simon & Schuster. And I manage a team of 8 editors and also publish books on my own list. I've been there for just a little over a year, close to a year and a half at this point.
And where were you before?
I came to SNS from Penguin Young Readers. I was at Viking Children's Books, and I had been there for 14 years. So it was a big, big change, big adjustment, yeah.
So the inevitable question, what prompted the big change and the big adjustment?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a combination of factors like it often is, but I had... sort of climbed as high as I could go there and was very happy in my role and really loved my team. And this opportunity came along, and the sort of one thing that I couldn't get there was the experience of what it was like to work somewhere else. And I mean, in a way I had gotten that more than you would expect because I had worked at Penguin when it was on its own. I had worked at Penguin Random House, which was sort of a different animal altogether. And so I had the good fortune to get a lot of really varied experience and work under different CEOs and different division heads and different publishers. So I think that's partly why I was able to stay in one place such a long time, because I did keep getting to learn new things from different people. But when this opportunity presented itself to head up this group at Simon & Schuster, it just felt like the right time to see what it was like to work somewhere else. And I've learned so much since I've been there. It's really been a great sort of reboot for my brain.
Now that Penguin's acquired Simon & Schuster, how does that catch up work?
I know. I've gotten a lot of teasing from my friends about
that. Yeah, you can't escape. Yeah. You can't catch me.
I mean, I was very happy when I heard that PRH was the one that was going to be buying Simon & Schuster, because given the fact that SNS was for sale, and that was just a reality. I mean, I like Penguin Random House a lot. I had a great experience there. I'm really familiar with the leadership there, and I respect them a lot. I know that as a company, they really champion books and authors, and they really care about literature very deeply. And I believe that they'll do a good job. I trust them. So I feel fine about it. And they're, you know, it's the children's book publishing industry is so small that everything sort of feels like it's all part of the same unit anyway. So, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference.
With this pandemic, we've all taken stock and reflected. What do you miss now? And what have you gained from this time?
It's been such a fascinating time for me. And it's sort of, I feel like for so many of us, it's giving us a kind of a life experience that nothing else could have. It's really made me appreciate my friends. I mean, I miss seeing my friends very much. As I mentioned, my husband and I are, or I don't know if I mentioned this, My husband and I are sort of house sitting long term for a friend who has a home in Maine. And so we're very fortunate to be able to do that and feel very, very grateful. It's quite isolating, and I do miss my friends a lot. And just on top of my friends and my friendships, I really miss the small, sort of seemingly insignificant interactions that you have with people on a day-to-day basis, kind of acquaintances, colleagues that you don't work that closely with, just people who, like the person at the coffee shop or the person at the grocery store. Like, I just miss talking to people in person. So I've really come to sort of appreciate those interactions when I get the rare opportunity to have one. And as far as on the other side of it, I mean, getting to be here has been an opportunity to take a break from New York City in a way that I haven't done in 20 years. And I was so young when I moved to New York, and I love New York. I love Brooklyn. I really consider it my home. And, you know, 20 years is kind of a long time. So it's really nice to get the opportunity to just see what it's like to live somewhere else, and not under normal circumstances, but to just take a pause from the New York pace has been really eye-opening.
What part of Maine are you in?
Just outside of Portland.
Okay. Yeah, beautiful. Are you in the snow right now?
Right now, it's not that snowy. There's a little bit on the ground, but it's been sort of off and on. But it's been a real gift to have the chance to spend more time sort of a little bit closer to nature. I mean, we're not like deep in the woods or anything. We're in a suburban neighborhood, but the ocean is a few blocks away, and there are some sort of forest preserves that are in walking distance. And that's something that I really missed throughout my whole time in New York, and had to sort of enjoy on vacations. And it was always worth it because I was trading that for culture, theater, music, art, you know, and sort of like the wonderful social experience of life in the metropolis. Yeah, I have a lot of friends who are still there, and I spent the first 4 months of the pandemic there when it was sort of like the very intense lockdown of the spring. And I sort of look at back at my journal from that time, and it's not like I was miserable or anything. You know, I was very grateful to still be working, which I'm still very grateful for. And I was going and walking in the park. I was finding pleasure in cooking, which I still am, and, you know, in other things that I like to do on my own. So it's, yeah, I mean, one can definitely have a satisfying life within it. It's been nice to just sort of have a change of scene and get to be having a different experience for a while, because novelty and variety are in short supply right now. So I'm
truly
fortunate to get to experience some of that.
So give me a day in the life of now that we're in Portland, Maine. So when people submit to you, is it the same sort of procedure? Do you have the same access? How does your team work with you remotely?
Everything's the same, to the extent that everything's different for everyone. And so many people that I work with have scattered to different places temporarily, just like I have. We have folks that are all over the country right now. So functionally, from an author or an agent's perspective, it shouldn't be a very different experience. If anything, it has sort of really opened the door for more video chatting, which I really appreciate. And I love getting to see people and talk with them. And it's something that I'm really accustomed to, because as a life coach, which is sort of my side hustle, career. I've been a life coach for over a decade, and I've been talking to people on video chat. I'm very comfortable with and accustomed to talking to people in this way. And when we were back in the office, it was always like, oh God, somebody wants to video chat. We don't even have videos on our, you know, we don't even have like video cameras on our computers. And you would only sort of get that request from somebody who worked in like Silicon Valley or something, you
know? Right.
And now everybody's so much more comfortable with it. And I really like that because I can be on a call. I'm collaborating on a book with our counterparts in the UK right now. And it's lovely. I mean, yesterday I was on a call with the UK editor and the author, and we're all in different places, and it's very easy to just connect and be sort of on a level playing field. And I really appreciate that. And that's really, to answer your question, that's how I've been interacting with my team is, you know, we have a lot of video calls, and every once in a while we'll have sort of like an old fashioned phone call, but generally we're chatting over video.
So given that this is called Passion to Power, we have two pods that have sort of gained in the analytics, the 18 to 24 crowd that's on their Yellow Brick Road to Success. There's aspiring artists, authors, actors, activists that listen, and many of whom I've actually engaged with over the years at different universities with my workshops. That's my side hustle, Passion to Power. How to, you know, strategize your career as a young person. And then, interestingly enough, surpassing that pod now is the 42 to 60 year old pod of people. And I say that they're all pivoting and doing triple pirouettes right now. Many of us have had to shift and morph, and I've kind of made a career of that, but it's new for a lot of people who are used to working for a company and then all of a sudden they're not, or they're interviewing like this, right? Do you find that this new reality is comfortable for you? Do you see this as being a way to do work for the next several months? And what does, you know, what's the word coming from the top down at Simon & Schuster about how that's going to be done?
I think it's been very hard for any of the publishing companies to really make a definitive statement about what the future is going to look like as far as remote working, because it's really hard to know sort of the timeline. I think people are hoping they'll have a better sense in a few months after the Biden administration is really fully installed and there's more of like a clear plan coming from the government. When there's more of a vaccine rollout, I think maybe there'll be a better sense. But right now, it's all pretty up in the air. I've talked to so many people, and I think I hardly know anybody that hates everything about remote working. And I know more people, I guess, who love it. And I would put myself and a lot of people I know in the middle, where there are a lot of aspects of it that I really appreciate, and I would be fine to continue doing it. And there are certainly things I miss about being in the office, and I don't think that's going to go away, that missing of those things. I really miss being able to just sit down with members of my team and go over something together, physically, personally. I edit a lot of picture books, and I'm doing a lot of sharing with my team about how to edit picture books, because some of them aren't very familiar with that format. And it's hard to teach that this way. And it's hard to sort of do the thing that I do a lot when I'm trying to teach a junior staff member, which will be like, hey, you know what, just come and sit in on this meeting. I can do it remotely. I can do that remotely, but you do miss a lot of those sort of side conversations that you just overhear when you're a junior person that you learn a lot from. Now, on the flip side, for sort of work-life balance and personal comfort, there's a lot that I like about the remote working situation. I think establishing the right work-life balance when you work remotely is pretty challenging, but it's a priority for me, and it's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. I really like what I was saying before, being able to talk to people anywhere, anytime, and having us all feel on a level. We've had a couple of big sales conferences, which back in the office, it would be some of us in person and then some people on the phone or in the ceiling, as people would say, because the speakers are in the ceiling. And you can't see them and you sort of forget they're there sometimes. And then you hear a comment from them that they're all interrupting each other and it's very awkward. Doing it this way, we're all remote. We're all on in the same size of little square. And it really makes for a much smoother conference. So that's a long way of saying there are pros and cons, and I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't even know what I hope will happen, really.
Do you know how it's affected employment at your company? Have there been layoffs?
We haven't had any major layoffs. I think every company has really had to be, you know, kind of like tighten their belts during this time, especially the beginning of the pandemic. But I would say, and you find this, I think, with just about anybody you would talk to in children's book publishing, the companies have done surprisingly well this past year. I think that there were big losses as far as the school sales, the sales that we usually have to schools and to libraries. That was a really challenging area. And it's much harder for people to browse. There's not that kind of bookstore traffic that we count on. At the same time, families were buying a lot of books for at-home education. And I think we saw a big uptick there. So a lot of it is less of losses and more of shifting in where people are buying and who's buying and stuff like that. So it's hard to know what's coming next, but I know that companies are really, you know, everybody recognizes that this is a difficult time for everybody and nobody's keen to let people go. So so I think companies are trying to do the best they can to make things work.
So I want to know how you got into children's books and why. What appealed to that world?
Sure. Yeah, I really sort of fell into it a little bit. I wasn't somebody who grew up with a dream about being in publishing. But when I was in college, I got an email from an editor at Scholastic, and he was letting me know that a short story that I had written that had won a Scholastic Writing Award when I was in high school had been selected to be included in an anthology that he was putting together of works from previous awards. And he was sort of writing to get my permission. And I didn't know who he was. I never heard of him. It was David Levithan, who is like quite a big name.
I know David.
So I thought, oh, well, this is very cool. And I wrote him back and said, like, yes, of course, like, that's wonderful. And I happened to just be moving to New York right around that time to go to college. So I think I mentioned that. And he was like, oh, well, you know, if you're looking for an internship, you should come in and an interview for an internship. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. So I went in and I ended up getting the internship. And he paired me with Joy Peskin, who was an editor at Scholastic in the paperback group at the time. And Joy and I were just like instant connection. And she became my mentor and just an incredibly dear friend and is still one of my very dearest friends. I love her so much.
We just reconnected on LinkedIn. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's editorial director of FSG Children's. Yeah. She's just the most amazing person. And she really kind of introduced me to the world of children's book publishing and taught me so much and showed me what this job is. And of course, it's funny to look back on now because at the time she seemed so sophisticated and worldly and mature and old. She was 28 and like,
wow.
It's just funny to think about now, but I just really kind of fell in love with children's book publishing, and I had always been a big reader as a kid, and I didn't really know that this was a job, and I was studying playwriting and screenwriting at NYU, so I was going to school just down the road from Scholastic, and sitting in all these workshops, learning how to critique people's work and how to give constructive feedback, and all about craft and process and stuff like that, so it just ended up really making a lot of sense for me. And I interned at Scholastic for pretty much as long as I could get away with. And in the interim, Joy left and went to Penguin. And then I interned for Kristen Earhart, who was another wonderful editor at Scholastic at the time. And after I graduated, I was like, well, I guess I'm just going to keep trying to get a job working for one of these people. And I ended up getting a job in the book clubs at Scholastic. So not an editorial role, but a really fascinating way to start in the business, because it's book clubs are like, there's nothing else quite like them at any other house. And it's sort of a marketing job, and it's sort of a sales job, and it's sort of like, it's a little bit of everything. It's a little editorial, it's a little bit of all the things. And so I got to really get a good bird's eye view of what all the houses are publishing, because we could consider all of them for inclusion in the catalog. So it was a great way to start out, but I did really want to do editorial. And so when Joy called me up and said that she was looking for an assistant at Viking to assist her and two other editors, I was like, oh my God, that's my dream job. And I was fortunate enough to get that job. And that's sort of how I really got into the editorial track and began my career at Viking.
So describe the day in the life of an editor. What is an editor? Because you mentioned film and television, an editor means something totally different in that world. And then there's the difference between being an editor and being acquisitional editor, which is a term unique to the book publishing world. So could you describe what that means?
Sure. So in the world of children's book publishing, an editor's typical day is filled with so many different things, which is part of what has kept me doing this and part of what I like about it. Editors review submissions from agents or unagented submissions, and you know, they will read stuff that comes in and also seek out talent, reach out to talented people that they are aware of and say, hey, you know, I think you have a book in you, or that kind of thing. So different ways of finding material. And then they will sort of present it to colleagues in sales, marketing, whatever, and ultimately end up acquiring the book. They work on the book, they work with the author and possibly the illustrator to make it better and to get it really ready for publication. And then, I mean, they're really sort of like the hub of a wheel with many spokes, because the editor is the author's kind of in-house liaison to the design department, particularly if it's a picture book or an illustrated book, then, you know, there's lots to do with the art director. To the marketing department, the editor will present the book and share it with marketing, and marketing will figure out how they want to promote the book, and the editor kind of liaises with them. You have copy editing, who work on, you know, getting it in just perfect shape with all the grammar correct and everything. Then of course you have sales, you have your sales team, and they need to figure out how to talk about the book to their accounts, whether it's little indie bookstores or big Barnes & Noble, big chain, or Amazon, you know, whoever it might be. They need to figure out how to kind of position the book, and you as the editor help them do that. So you're really kind of like touching all of the different parts of the bookmaking process. And so it's, I think a lot of people have an idea in their head that a book editor sort of like sits quietly and is marking up a manuscript with a blue pencil, but it's really not a lot of that. I mean, you have to do that, but often editors sort of end up doing that kind of in their free time almost, because there's so much else involved with liaising with all these people and trafficking all these different communications and making sure that the author's needs are being met, that the agent is, you know, satisfied, and that every department kind of has what they need.
So do you think it's easier or harder to land a book deal in the children's world versus other adult book genres?
I have no idea. I've never worked in adult, and I don't know the world very well, so I really couldn't say.
So what's the criteria for you? What makes a great children's book?
Well, it depends a little bit on the category. And one of the things that I love so much about working in children's is that we do have so much variety. I mean, working on a picture book is very different from working on a young adult novel, which is very different from working on, say, a middle grade graphic novel or a traditional middle grade novel or a nonfiction book. You know, like there's so many different kinds of books that you get into, and each of them you sort of do have your own rubric for evaluating. But I think the first thing that I'm always thinking about is, will a child like this? And I think while it's good for editors to be connected to kind of our own past, like, child selves, we don't want to rely too heavily on that, because the world has changed a lot since any of us were kids, even our most junior folks. Right. I mean, it's changed a lot in just like the past year. So we have to really be connected to what kids and their families might be wanting now, and what might be appealing to them now, not just when we were kids ourselves.
So if I can segue and brag a little bit, this book, I just wanted to share it with you, has had a viral life, and then we reinvented it, The Invisible String. And this book has become so loved over the pandemic because it's about invisible strings of love connecting us. I don't know if you're familiar with Patrice Carr's work. And then we did The Invisible Leash, and then there was a workbook, and now The Invisible Web. And what I love about the message is it's so concrete. So when we're pitching film and television, you know, you have a log line. I imagine with a children's book that that's what appeals to you, the simplest of message, right? That you can articulate and then come to life in just, what, under 1,000 words generally, correct?
If you're talking about a picture book, yeah, it would be a very concise text. And yeah, you do want to be able to crystallize it pretty easily. And I would say that's the case with any book of any age category or any type of book. Ideally, you would like to be able to crystallize it in a sentence that people can instantly understand. Now, I've edited a lot of books for which that was not the case. And in fact, I often am drawn to them. I like complexity. I like books that work on many levels. I do think that if you can distill it easily, it makes it a lot easier to market, to sell, to communicate to people.
How often can you break the mold of what's the expectation of a children's book? For example, a book that has a longer word count or more words on the page, or, you know, I mean, occasionally there's something that is a new style book that reverts to the old style books when I was a kid.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can do it anytime as long as you do it extremely well. I mean, that's sort of the trick, right? It's like a lot of people could paint in a style that might be reminiscent of like what Picasso was doing, but if they're not as good as Picasso, then it's just going to look like they don't really know what they're doing. You need to do it. Your standards need to be even higher, and you need to do it really fabulously. A book from my childhood that I feel like is a good example of that is The Stinky Cheese Man by John Sheska and Lane Smith. I mean, that was one of my favorite books when I was a kid, and even more so when I was a teenager, because I would bring it when I would babysit. And it was so much fun to read aloud. And that book breaks every kind of rule. It's so long. It's totally crazy in the way that it's laid out. It does all these things you're not supposed to do. And it does it so well. And kids love the sort of the anarchic feel of it, and the sort of the sense that they are complicit in the chaos that's on the page. And so I think that when a book draws readers in and allows them to participate in what's happening in that way, and does it really excellently, I think it can be just so, so wonderful.
In the world of film and television, and I would say in the Hollywood area, except, as you know, I'm in the fire zone in Thousand Oaks, but typically we are working in the West Coast, which is different compared to a lot of boutique agencies and lit that are in New York. But one of the appeals here is our book to screen availability, right? We have a lot of opportunities to pitch. And I'm wondering now, in the world of YA, young adult, so many of these great books have turned into big movies, right? What do you look for in a young adult book? What is resonant and riveting for you?
Young adult as a category has really shifted a lot in the time that I've worked in publishing. I mean, and when I started out, it was really just starting to be a category. And it's gone through this sort of like becoming huge, 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 and many adults getting into it. And then I think there was a little bit of a falling off there. And now I think it's a little bit more back to just a core teen audience, but what I really look for in young adult is a really distinctive voice. I mean, to me, that's, I care what the story is about. I care, you know, kind of like what the style is, but what I care about most of all is this voice really distinctive and special and something that I haven't read before? I'm fortunate enough to be working with Mary H.K. Choi now, who's such a just beyond phenomenal writer. And one of the things that I really love about working with her is that her voice is immediately recognizable. It couldn't possibly be anyone else but her. It is so distinctive. It's unique. And it's, she says things and sees the world in a way that no one else does. And that's really what I hope to find when I open a manuscript of a YA novel that I haven't read yet, is a really special voice that's gonna give me truly a new lens through which to see the world.
I love the way you speak, Kendra. You're so articulate. And I totally get it. Do you have pre-readers?
Like for submissions?
Yeah, do people take a look, your beta readers, before they hand it over to Kendra?
That's not really how I structure things. As the editorial director of a group with 8 editors in it, I funnel a lot of submissions. So I do receive things and pass them along to editors in my group if I think they might be a fit for them, partly because I can't handle the volume that I get, but more importantly because I have a more established network than some of them do, and I want to make sure that they are making connections with agents that might not be thinking of them right now. I want them to be thinking of them next time they go out with something.
And did you handpick your team, or were you were sort of assigned to them and they were already hired?
Our group has come together in a variety of different ways. It's quite different than the group that it was when I first joined, but some of the editors were there when I came on board. Some I have hired, and some have joined our group from other groups within the company as a result of some restructuring. So it's a bigger group than it was when I joined, and I think a really wonderful group. I mean, I love the editors that I get to work with, and it's really my pleasure to get to kind of be in this with them every day, and especially during some of the tougher moments during the past year. I've been very grateful for them because they kind of give me a reason to pull it together and show up and kind of show up for them. And it's helped me to show up for myself.
So since you thought Joy Peskin was old when she was 28, how old is your core group? Is there an age of a typical editor?
Oh, there's a real range. I mean, we have on the junior end, we have folks that are fairly recently out of college. In our particular group, I don't think we have anybody that's like quite established and senior in a long-term career way. Just within my group I'm talking about, I think I'm might be the oldest person. So I think it's a fairly young group.
For our listeners, I'm looking at Kendra and she still looks 28 herself. So let's just be clear when she says she thinks she's the oldest.
I'm on the leading edge toward 40.
Okay. And still looks 28. That's hysterical.
But I moisturize twice a day. So.
Right. So do you have cats?
I don't have cats.
No cats. Dogs?
I don't have any pets.
So you have no distractions other than the occasional, bird. I want to talk about the life coaching. That's an interesting side hustle. And is that a compliment with an E to the work as an editor?
It has turned out to be, and that wasn't what I had in mind when I got into it. It's something that I pursued quite early in my editorial career, now that I look back on it. I was still an assistant and I was just kind of feeling like, I don't know, is this it? Like, isn't there more to life, kind of? And I didn't really know about life coaching. I had always thought I might eventually become a therapist, and I wasn't sure when that might be. I wasn't very keen on going to grad school and sort of dealing with the financial issues there and the time commitment and all that stuff. So I met a woman at a party who we were just, oh, what do you do? What do you, I was, oh, I work in publishing. What about you? She said, oh, I'm a power woman. And I was like, oh, whoa, that's really cool. Like, tell me more about that. And it turned out she was a life coach, and she sort of shared with me a lot more about what a life coach is, and that it is in some ways similar to a therapist, but with very different training and not the level of qualifications, but it's really about making goals or helping people to make goals and to sort of figure out what they want. And I ended up getting really interested in it and taking a certification course that lasted just not quite a year. It was very intensive, and like, I'm glad I did it when I did. I never could have done it later as my job got more involved. But at that point, I sort of thought, well, maybe I'll like hang out a shingle and go off and try and do my own thing. And right around the time, within the year that I completed this certificate, the economy tanked. This was like 2008. And boy, hang on to the job that you have if you have it. And I got promoted, and I went from assisting to getting to start to build my own list. And it was like the light coming through the clouds to sort of see, oh, this is what this job can be once you really like get on the track with it. And so I was liking my job so much more that I didn't really want to abandon it, but I wanted to coach. And so I was doing that just sort of one evening a week. And many years later, here I am still doing it one evening a week. And it's still just a really fulfilling outlet for me. I love to problem solve with people, and I love to get to know people and hear about their lives. And it really fulfills me to get to apply those skills. And I get to use them in my job all the time now as a manager. I coach every single day as a manager. So I'm really grateful that I developed that skill set. Came out with a book a few years ago called The Hero Is You. And it sort of draws on my experiences as an editor and also as a coach of working with writers in lots of different capacities over the years. So it's sort of a self-help book for writers. And it takes the idea of the hero's journey and sort of the fundamental ideas of Joseph Campbell, the mythology scholar, and uses it as a lens through which you can see your own creative process. So it's kind of like setting up this big metaphor of you, the writer, or any kind of artist really, are a hero on your own journey, and the creative process is that journey. And it's one that you go through many, many, many times over the course of your creative career or your life. And so it offers a bunch of different tools, kind of coaching tools drawn from my coaching experience to help writers and other artists kind of get through the creative process and find ways to play an active role in creating their own process that will be most kind of holistic for their life and help them do their best work.
Sounds a little bit like The Artist's Way, but more for a writer. Is that kind of the direction? Is it a workbook?
It's not a workbook per se, but it does have a lot of exercises in it. And yeah, I mean, I definitely looked at The Artist's Way when I was working on it. And I even took a class with Julia Cameron just to kind of get a sense of her work. And I think what makes The Hero Is You different is it's really about process. Like, it's really all about kind of how do you set up your own creative process in a way that is going to be most kind of fulfilling and effective for you. And I think it's also a little bit for the next generation from The Artist's Way. You know, I think Julia Cameron was really writing for the kind of baby boomer generation who had had the experience of being told by their parents, you have to be a doctor, you have to be a lawyer, art, being an artist is a waste of time. And so I think she addressed that really beautifully in all of her work, you know, in her many sort of subsequent books too. What I was sort of after is a bit more of the sort of Gen X and older millennial crowd, which I'm a part of. And many of us, at least certainly those of us who grew up in relative privilege, were told as children, you can do anything. You can be whatever you want to be. Free to be you and me. You know, like that was sort of the message.
I still have that album with Marlo Thomas singing.
Oh my God, I haven't done it. It's such like deep, delicious nostalgia.
Right.
I really love it. But that, you know, our sort of boomer parents really wanted to let us know, like, no, what our parents taught us is wrong. You can be whatever you want to be. And so I think we all grew up believing that and then emerged into a world where that really was not our experience at all. And continues to be our experience that, you know, it's, you can't quite be just whatever you want to be just because you feel like it. So it's more addressing that experience and what it means to be a writer, be an artist in a world where that is a really challenging thing to be. It does require a lot of balancing. So this is the book, The Hero Is You.
Oh, it's a beautiful cover.
Thank you.
Is Canary a U.S. imprint or British?
Yeah.
It is. Oh, it's a big book.
Yeah, it's got this sort of like nice big trim size and it's paperback. So it's very kind of portable. And I mean, you asked if it's a workbook and it has a lot of exercises that I sort of recommend you do in a journal rather than inside the book itself. But I get messages all the time from groups like writers groups, critique groups that are doing the book together as sort of working their way through the exercises and that kind of thing. So it's a good I think it's a good book to do with maybe with a writer's group.
Okay, I love it. So this is funny because I was the agent on this book called I'm Talented Now What. So it would take that kind of an idea, but it's a workbook for performing artists, also millennials and Gen Zs. Okay, so my last question, and because I know you have to go, what does it mean, my list? Because that's everything to an editor. What does it mean, my list?
When you hear an editor say my list, what they mean is my books. And it's the individual books that they've acquired or inherited. Each of those books, each of those authors. And it also means my sort of editorial voice, my identity, my kind of brand as an editor. And when an agent sits down with an editor in person or virtually, you know, depending on when it's happening in time, the agent will want to hear about the editor's list, meaning they'll want to know, okay, well, like what kinds of subjects are you drawn to? What do you, you know, are you very into books that are all about social justice and making the world a better place? Are you all about books that are really kind of light and funny and just all about humor? Are you really into books that are kind of educational and teach a child something new? And an editor may want all of those different kinds of books on their list. And that variety is part of what makes it their list and part of what makes them who they are. And as people kind of, as editors sort of like come up in this business, I think you start to get a feel as an agent or as an editorial colleague for what is a that person book. And even if they edit lots of different kinds of books, oh, this one really feels like that person. And I think if you look at some of the really, really established names in our field, you can sort of immediately tell one of their books, it has their stamp on it. And it just has very much the feel of like, oh yeah, they would love that.
So getting back to something you said very early in the conversation about literature, do you acquire literature?
What does that mean to you?
So people bandy around the word literature as if it was more highbrow than some, you know, commercial books and And then there's been some, oh, shall I say, snobby editors I've talked to who are, oh, that doesn't meet my list, because they're talking about sort of more the highbrow. It's not literary enough. Can you kind of describe what you think that means?
Sure. I mean, I think, I don't know if you've had that conversation with anyone in children's, but I have found that the adult side of things has very different ideas of what literature means than what children's does. But yeah, I mean, there's a spectrum of from literary to commercial. But I think what most of us are looking for is something that's perfectly in the middle, you know, like that has literary writing meaning, like that voice thing that I talked about earlier, that it's really original, that it doesn't feel generic, it has a special quality to the writing, and the author clearly thought about form and didn't just kind of like blurt a bunch of words on a page in the first person, but really thought about, okay, yeah, like, should this be first person or third person or second person? Should this be, how do I want the timeline to work? What's the structure? You know, like somebody really thought about craft. And commercial meaning, like super accessible, appealing to a broad range of people, not dense, not sort of impenetrable or intimidating. Particularly writing for young people, it's like you don't want to scare people away. So that's sort of what commercial means to me. I think often the words literary and commercial get used as sort of dog whistles for commercial meaning, like sort of really mass appeal. And literary meaning, like, yeah, kind of highbrow. But certainly for me, and I think for everybody on my team, and for a lot of my colleagues in the industry, what we really want to find is something that is sort of that, in that nice middle place.
Cool. Well, I'm going to be sending you a couple of those books, and I hope you'll love them. And in the meantime, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you're participating in this conversation. So my podcasts are growing, I'm very proud to say, on Spotify, Apple, Radio Public, Stitcher, Anchor. I'll send you a list of the distribution. And I cover a range of topics, technology, performing arts, entertainment. And you're only the second person in the book publishing world I've interviewed. So I'm very, very excited to have this interview and share it with the world. I will pick up a copy of your book, or better yet, I might order it personally from you so you'll copy and sign it for me. I'd love that.
I would be happy.
Amazing. All right, well, go on with your many, many Zooms today. And Kendra Levin, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always, to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. I really appreciate your having me, and this has been a great conversation. So thanks for all your really wonderful questions.
Yeah, yeah. And you still look 28, I'm just going to say. All right. Have a wonderful day. Signing off. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.